Hello and welcome back to the Big Book Project. Big books demand heavy work, and we're up for it. In this podcast, we take on some of our favorite, often obscure and unpopular books, and unpack the ways in which they have made sense to us. In our first episode, we read Ejaz Ahmed's In Theory.
And in this episode, which is our second episode, Bhavin Patel and I, Atre Majumdar, are going to talk about a classic essay written by the essayist and theorist Walter Benjamin. It is called The Work of Art in an Age of Mechanical Reproduction.
Okay, so let's jump right into it, Atre. The essay this time around, rather than a book. Walter Benjamin, this is the first time I've ever read something by him. I'm blown away, of course, but there's one question that I think we need to take care of before we go in, which is that this is supposed to be a podcast about big books. And, you know, that suggests massive tomes running into hundreds and hundreds of pages, if not two or three volumes at least. Yet here we are with something relatively tiny, just about 40 pages or so. So is this then a big book in terms of its impact? And if so, how?
Indeed it is. This essay by Walter Benjamin, stretching 40-odd pages, was first published in 1936. And it has been republished recently as The Work of Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction by Penguin Great Ideas series, where it is appended by another essay by Benjamin on Proust. But we are focusing entirely on the first essay, which is Work of Art today. And this 40-page essay is a slim one. It doesn't count as a book in that sense, but it's a heavyweight in terms of the ideas that it carries. It's a classic essay in film theory, in aesthetic theory, in Marxist theory, and so on and so forth. Its argument is very relevant to our current times, where he's arguing that the use of technology in some senses has become second nature, what Benjamin would have said to us today as the optical unconscious. And I'm very excited to talk about the optical unconscious today.
Fantastic. Okay. So, all right, then we'll just take that at face value and accept for a moment that this book is impactful, even if it's not big, literally. But where does this fit in? Where does this essay fit in within the larger corpus of Benjamin's work? And maybe our audience might want to know a little more about Benjamin himself.
Right, I understand. So Walter Benjamin, a philosopher, a cultural critic, an essayist, and most excitingly, an aphorist, is a theorist of the 1920s through 1940s. He writes this particular essay in 1936, a few years before the World War II begins in Europe. His attachment to the Frankfurt School of Marxists in Germany is very clear. He's friends with various people in the Frankfurt School, like Adorno and Horkheimer. Several aesthetic theorists of the time are his friends, including the theater person Bertolt Brecht. His essays, imagine being all of this, you know, this kind of fertile intellectual in Europe at this time, and being a German Jew. He led a very difficult life. He also died by suicide at a time where he was hoping to flee Europe, but he couldn't flee Europe at the right time, and he died by suicide. His two very difficult and important essays are Critique of Violence and Theses on the Philosophy of History, which I've tried teaching and failed often enough. But I am actually more drawn to his aphoristic city essays, which are curated in these two volumes called Reflections and Illuminations. Both are kind of collections of his essays, especially the essays that he wrote on his favorite cities of Europe, Paris, Berlin, and Moscow. And he had an unfinished magnum opus, which is a series of notes and aphorisms about urbanism and capital in Paris, which is called the Arcades Project, which was published posthumously, which is many years after he died. He is indeed a Marxist, and as we are betraying some sort of Marxist leanings in this podcast, But he's not a Marxist of the usual variety, and we are not the Marxists of usual variety, I believe. He's very much a theorist of urban space, especially Paris as an urban venue, as an urban canvas on which capital's raw hungers are playing out. And that becomes the crux of his Arcades project. And the key site, I believe, of the making of Benjamin's Marxism. Cinema and the current essay that we are reading is a testing ground for his Marxism. And I think I'll stop there.
Quite the interesting character. And as you were saying, that that reminded me of an incident that a friend told me about. Apparently, at one point, things got fairly heated between Benjamin and Adorno. And I'm told, I have no way of knowing if this is actually true. I'm told that Benjamin actually smacked Adorno one across the face. So, yeah, I mean, they were friends, but they clearly had their disagreements. And may I just say that perhaps in a way, it's lucky that you and I aren't in the same city right now, and only meeting over Zoom makes smacking the other person across the face slightly more difficult. Hopefully, I won't provoke you to that extent. Okay, so this is useful to know. Benjamin was all of these things and did and said so many different things. But the one thing that I think anyone who's read The Work of Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction will take away, or will probably remember at parties where the name of this essay comes up, is the term aura. And Benjamin talks about how technological reproducibility removes the aura of a work of art. And rather than go into what that might be, hint, hint, read the essay for yourself. It's a fantastic, brilliant, difficult, but brilliant read. That got me thinking to whether two things in particular, transience and disintermediation, are important constituents of aura. So let me just sort of elaborate on that. And because I don't get to talk enough on these podcasts, I framed a rather large question. So here it is. How is transience related to aura? So consider, for example, that even now, a century almost after that essay was written, with technology progressing ever more rapidly, masses of people across the world are still very happy to pay large amounts of money and go and watch a live sporting event in a stadium. You know, let's say something like an IPL match or a World Cup final, something like that. But the same group of people may be unwilling to take much less effort to go and watch a traveling exhibition of a work of art in a museum. So, is there then something in witnessing a live event, a transient, fleeting event, something that only happens once? Is there that thing that the contemporary age then emphasizes as the new marker of aura? Consider also, for example, things like memes. And they're here now, gone tomorrow. You can't really always go back and find them. Everything on social media seems to be fleeting. It's impermanent. And it creates a sense of urgency to witness that work. So then, is this transience and the resultant urgency, that impermanence, a new way of creating aura? And if you recall all those things that Benjamin talks about, the difference between cinema and theater, and how the mediation of the camera changes everything for a theater actor who might otherwise be able to modify their performance to the audience. Is this removal of the camera then another contributor of aura? So, and I promise this is my last leg of this question. More fully, are disintermediation and transience necessarily interlinked and inseparable creators of aura in today's world?
Bhavan, let me first ask you, what exactly do you mean in the use of the term disintermediation?
Sure. So Benjamin talks about how the camera, in a way, mediates between the film actor and the audience. The film audience doesn't really see the actor directly. What they see is what the camera and then the editor has chosen to bring before them. And that makes a difference, right? Because you don't see what you would otherwise in real life. He talks about how effects such as close-ups or slow motion just completely transform the nature of what you are viewing. And so that is a completely mediated experience. Mm-hmm. And that's what you might see on a television, for example. But if you go to the stadium and watch a match, which is the first example I picked up, there is no such mediator. And that's the sense in which I use the term disintermediation.
Intermediation. I understand. There are many questions there, Bhavan. Let me first take a slightly conservative view on Benjamin and read Benjamin a little bit closely. I'll read out parts of the text, if that's okay. Let me tackle the question of transience and aura first. He says on page 9, getting closer to things in both spatial and human terms is every bit as passionate a concern of today's masses as their tendency to surmount the uniqueness of each circumstance by seeing it in reproduction. He's kind of chiding the masses of the day for wanting this immediacy, this kind of urgency, and wanting it in the reproducible format all the time. I once watched kind of, you know, Marilyn Monroe's kind of famous skirt go up scene, and then I must watch it reproduce endlessly in murals, in graffiti, in comics, in everything, right? It transcends the particular kind of cinematic form in which you have first seen Marilyn Monroe's skirt go up, but then you want to see that several times over in several different formats. And what does that mean? Benjamin is saying that transience and reiterability are related to the reproduction element, just as uniqueness and duration are with a real work of art. He is kind of fetishizing the real in that sense here, and that is true. But we must give him some credit for talking in the 1930s, where film is just about coming up. It's an emergent form. He can't even imagine social media and internet and such things. He's saying stripping the object of its sheath and shattering the aura is how the reproduced image of the real emerges. Stripping the object of the sheath, shattering the aura. These two things are where an image becomes unmoored to its image form and travels into this reproducible realm. I think Benjamin would have said that aura is contained in the interaction with the real, in the visceral experience of the immediacy, the uniqueness. In that sense, I'm saying watching a goal or a perfect goal or a perfect six in a cricket match or a football match live in the stadium is very much within the realm of Benjamin's aura. It doesn't have to be watching a work of art in a kind of elite bourgeois museum kind of space where everyone doesn't feel comfortable. It is only when that match or that perfect goal gets reiterated in the live television format that you can see that perfection be played out in front of your eyes ever so often, again and again. That is where Benjamin is saying that your optical unconscious is interrupted. He says somewhere in the book, somewhere in the essay, that you are watching, you know, say, an object, you know, like say a tiger or a bull moving, and it moves slowly in the work of art. It's still, you're tied to its body. It caught in a moment, which is still, right? And you have no choice but to devote your attention to that moment. In film, what is happening, you're watching 500 images of that same bull watching, you know, like moving its arms or its limbs around in the most delightfully violent fashion. And you're watching this 500 stills move in perfect synchrony across the time length of maybe 2 seconds. And that is what is interrupting your optical unconscious. You have no time to consider the first moment of the bull's body. And that is where the aura is broken. There's an aura that is captured in stillness, in uniqueness, and it's somewhat provisional permanence, and it is disturbed by reiterability and transience. transience, meaning not that it can't be repeated before, but it is happening in the in a fleeting manner, in a matter of few seconds or even nanoseconds. At the end of the way, where you also talk about this in your question on page 17 and 18, he says there are two ways in which a film viewer watches a performer's performance, an actor's performance, and is unattached to the actor. Two ways. First way is that he doesn't actually watch the performer's performance in entirety. He watches a heavily manipulated, cut and curated version of the actor's performance that is put on display by the editor and the director in the form of a film. He doesn't actually watch the performer perform like directly with his naked eyes. The second is that the audience has to evaluate the performance without any closeness or contact with the performer. The audience empathizes with the performer, but only, and these are Benjamin's words, by empathizing with the camera. So Benjamin is really indicting the camera here. This entire essay, I feel like it's a kind of calling the bluff of the camera. And having said, taken this kind of, you know, conservative textual view of Benjamin, let me come to your question, your point about memes and influencer culture on Instagram and TikTok and so on and so forth. This transience, you know, this kind of ephemera that you're talking about, which might be having an aura of its own, I would say it does have an aura, but not in the Benjaminian sense. Simply because it is the casting of the camera lens on everything real and beautiful and frightening and ugly and visceral that is about the world that Benjamin kind of brings to question. Why this camera is coming in the middle of everything, our viewing of the world at large. Benjamin's essay could be revised today in the context of the ubiquity of the phone camera. We see nothing in a naked encounter between our eyes and the aura of the object that we actually see. Benjamin would have been devastated, I think, had he witnessed today's social media infused kind of screen infested visual field. The fleeting nature of a meme or an Instagram story, I think, would not be generating, I doubt would be generating any kind of aura in the Benjaminian sense, if I were to channel him for a moment. The reason being that the consumption of these particular performative phenomena are all in the register of mediated images. We don't see, say, Kunal Kamra doing it, unless you go to the comedy show, in a bar, you see Kunal Kamra constantly on your phone. You see constantly various other influencers doing their thing or, their kind of memes or whatever on your phone. And it's a phone camera that is doing the work of your consumption of the image. And in that sense, it's breaking the optical unconscious. I think, but I do think a revision of Benjamin's theory of the aura is possible in consideration of today's kind of ubiquity of the phone camera, which is something that he could not have imagined at his time, that there would be a phone, some such thing as a phone, as a cell phone, and then that it would have a camera and everyone would have a camera at their disposal at all times.
It's amazing that you bring up the mobile phone camera. And yesterday, as I was reading the book once again and trying to pretend that I could make sense of it, one of the questions that came up in my mind was, how would Benjamin have reacted, not even to things like memes or TikToks or influencer culture or whatever, but this compulsive need that so many of us seem to have now to photograph everything. This compulsive need not just to become, in a way, producers of art from mere consumers, not just that, but also to include ourselves or our own images within that, taking your selfies or taking your pictures at exotic locations or with new clothes or whatever. I wonder what Benjamin would have said about that. I mean, that's, well, we'll probably never know, but
I think that Benjamin would have been a precursor to Sontag's treatment of this very question. you know, why is it that you have to go to Eiffel Tower and point at it and take a photo? That, see, I was here. Not only that I was here, that Eiffel Tower, I'm pointing with my finger, is right behind me. She says is a certain kind of routine and mandate of bourgeois life, where we cannot live life in the relaxed, in the kind of non-productive mode. So when we actually go for holidays, we feel that something productive has to be done. And the taking of the photograph is that productive element where I have something to take away and show the world for it, that I relaxed, but in this way. This is what came out of my relaxation. This is what came out of my holiday. I think Benjamin would have taken a far more. Susan Sontag is still being kinder. She's writing in the 70s, where war photography and all kinds of common photography is quite much more common than it was at Benjamin's time. But Benjamin in the 1930s, I think, would have just said this is bunkum. A lot of people are just losing their minds, and with cinema, he is saying that. That the ubiquity of the camera is making people lose their mind, so that they cannot hold attention to one image for more than 5 minutes. More than they can't stand there and see a bull being painted on a mural if the bull is not moving or doing something fantastic or something violent or something scary. And this need for constant stimulation begins with film. And today we are seeing a very, very high point of this. And I think I'll be a conservative on Benjamin's side and say that that it has attacked our minds particularly badly.
By all means, but I'm going to take Benjamin's side away from you, because and I've got to be honest. I mean, I had a fairly similar view, but this changed because I was listening to all sorts of people talk about Benjamin in the run-up to this. And here's an interesting thought. I think the idea that Benjamin is at any point bemoaning the loss of aura is somewhat misplaced. Okay. I'm not entirely sure that Benjamin is upset at this or he's sad about this. I think he says this in a very matter-of-fact way. But what's more important to look at is where it's coming from and where it's going. So he talks about how the work of art initially had a role to play in magic or ritual or religion of some sort. It had some sort of cultic value, and therefore it was extremely tightly controlled. The idol, he says, for example, can never leave the temple, and so only a certain small group of people can see it. That changes then as the panel painting emerges, and it's in a gallery. Still not so many people, but there's a larger number that can see this. And even when he goes on to talk about film, he actually cites another film critic who says, I can no longer pay attention or think about anything. Everything is being done for me by the camera, by the editor. I'm being told what to think. I'm not sure that he says that himself. I think It's important to note that, and I'm going to just read out, I think, two lines from page 12, which I think are instructive here. He says, however, the instant the criterion of genuineness in art production failed, the entire social function of art underwent an upheaval. Rather than being underpinned by ritual, it came to be underpinned by a different practice, politics. And he goes on to talk about how film, for example, can be politicized, can be used in a political sense. It can reach so many more people, and how our current age is characterized by massification. You know, that seems to be, he indicates, one sort of side effect of capitalism. Everything happens in large masses. The relationship of the masses to reality and of reality to masses, he says somewhere else, also changes. He acknowledges, and he draws himself short at the last moment as he carries on in this enthusiastic jubilation of film, that there are two ways that this could happen. One is the American Los Angeles Hollywood sort of way, where it is tightly capitalistically controlled. But he contrasts that with, for example, Soviet film, where the everyday, the ordinary can be filmed, where everyone, for example, has a chance of seeing themselves in that. And of course, we'll come back to the question of how it could be used for fascistic purposes later. So there is that danger. But I think all he's saying really is that taking away this aura means that the function, the nature of art has changed, and that it can be used in a political sense now, whereas earlier that would have been that much more difficult, or perhaps very, very limited. But I'm not sure that Benjamin wouldn't have sent you a meme if he were alive today. I think he'd totally chill with that. I think I
really, you think so?
absolutely. I don't think Benjamin would want anything that promotes this idea of uniqueness and the concomitant values of genius, of somehow being special and tightly controlled. And that's something that he takes care to knock out as soon as he starts the essay. Right? He says that these values lend themselves to fascistic purposes, and then goes on to talk about how these are now gone. But anyway, I mean, that's a sort of one way of looking at it.
Sure. I mean, I would just, if I can respond, I would just say that I don't think he's bemoaning a kind of pre-modern time. That's not what he's doing. But he's saying that this time that we're entering, which is like the production, and if you read this along with his thesis on the philosophy of history and along with his Arcades project, which is basically seeing the boulevards of Paris as they're being captured by the raw hunger of capital, he's very much kind of bothered by the dream worlds that capital is weaving. And I think that he would see social media as an extension of capital's dream worlds, where it kind of keeps its subjects drugged, literally drugged, and in the way that our young folk and our generation too are literally drugged by social media today, that, you know, like we can't keep our fingers off the scrolling button. And it's this kind of mass hysteria where people forget what is real, what is important, what is beautiful, etc. In that sense, some fundamentals that keep you rooted to the world, to life at large, capital makes you kind of neglect those things, forget the fact that there is a beautiful piece of art in a cave in the Himalayas, which you will see only if you care to go to the Himalayas and climb up the mountains. You can't see it in a film form anywhere. So I think he was very aware of that kind of drugging, building of a certain kind of mass narcissism by capital. And that's what he's kind of indicting capital for. And he's saying that it's possible to use this. Yeah, you're right, totally. That it's possible to use this medium for a different kind of political art. But by political art, I don't think Benjamin would have meant like deadpan socialist realism art, which is something like I myself have an aesthetic problem with, that kind of deadpan, like I'd give me a dish of Hollywood any day, or a dish of even Bollywood or Tamil cinema any day, which is like, you know, so resplendent in its visual canvas. I'll stop there.
No, you're right. And perhaps, yes, this is a spur to me to read more Benjamin and then circle back to this idea, because I can't, like you, at this point, place it within the context of his other work. But how archaic, Atri? I mean, who says scrolling button anymore? I mean, phones don't even have buttons anymore. Like, what is this?
What is it called? I don't know what it's called.
I think you just call it scrolling now. You just doom scroll.
Oh, you just call it doom scroll. Yeah, that's what I meant.
Yeah, that's doom what all the cool scroll. Kids say. I think you just doom scroll anymore. So, okay. But so let's stick with aura for a moment. And here we go. You know, just as we promised we won't get mired in aura, here we are talking more and more about it. And I'm going to connect this to an idea building on top of technological reproducibility. I think it's fair to say that Benjamin acknowledges that technical or technological reproducibility doesn't just come about and exist for its own sake. It's perhaps more broadly described as the possibility of commercial reproducibility. I mean, art is reproduced for commercial purposes, for capitalistic purposes. And there's one thing that he doesn't talk about explicitly, perhaps because of the time he wrote this at, which is, and forgive my inner lawyer, the impact of copyright law on art. So we've seen, for example, in the last 100 years or so, let's take Mickey Mouse, for example. This is a character that's around that old, was first popular around Benjamin's time, and Benjamin apparently wrote this essay praising Mickey Mouse no end and how it was a fantastic instrument to bring about laughter in the masses. But legal instruments have been deployed to reduce the possibilities of reproduction of such art forms. And that leads to the cult of the brand, right? So here's something that came up just last evening. I was sitting speaking with a young friend, and they were telling me about sneakerheads. So sneakerheads is a thing now. And
what are they?
So sneakerheads love sneakers. They collect sneakers. These aren't just your average, ordinary few thousand rupees or even a few tens of thousand rupee expensive sneakers. So there are, for example, limited edition sneakers, Air Jordan 1s or something like that, of which only 23 copies have ever been made. And these can sell for lakhs and lakhs of rupees, for hundreds and thousands of dollars. And of course, these are very, very tightly controlled by Nike, by the company that actually makes them. There's nothing particularly special about the shoes otherwise. It's not like you'll run faster, jump higher, or anything else. Most of us, even if we saw someone wearing a pair of shoes like that, would think, oh my God, how gaudy, and really, is this what you're spending money on? But the brand has managed to create once again that cultic value around that object. It's different from earlier times when, for example, there was one Mona Lisa and one only. This is technologically produced, and so therefore there isn't one original shoe. Even in a limited edition, there are 50 original pairs or 23 original pairs. But how is this cult of this copyrighted, legally protected brand, if at all, and the aura that surrounds it, how is that different from the aura of a work that Benjamin talks about?
Right, that's a difficult question. Let me try to make sense of it. Aura doesn't pin down, to my mind, to uniqueness per se. So it's not the Mona Lisa's oneness that generates its aura. It's in this interaction with that oneness. It's in the, you interact with the personality of the artwork. That's where the aura is contained. If, you know, there was, the Kedarnath deity up in the Himalayas, which is very high up, perhaps the highest kind of deity in the Hindu pantheon, is kind of difficult to access, and therefore its darshan is that much more kind of locked in an aura, because you have to climb up this kind of high mountain, take a lot of hardship. For elderly people it's even more difficult because the oxygen is limited, etc. And people do it to access this kind of singularity of this experience. The aura is contained in the experience. If no one were to come and, you know, Lord Shiva were to sit there by himself, there would be no aura. Right? What aura? So copyright generates, to my mind, I'm from those that older era of copyleft people. My students don't know what copyleft is anymore. But I believe copyright is a expression of a regime of property. And aura is not about property. It's not about how much it costs or who owns it, how regulated its access is. It's about what the energy or the synergy that is contained in one's unique interaction with an image or a work of art or a work of performance art, or whatever it may be. The art is singular, And your experience of watching it and interacting with its personality is singular. So much so that if large numbers of people go into a multiplex and watch, you know, Brahmastra, about which I'm hearing various things, and, you know, say there's Alia Bhatt and Ranbir Kapoor are running away from some fire or some natural disaster, everyone's consuming that same image at the same moment in a less singular manner. I would argue that there's some singularity even there. Everyone's not consuming, depending on where you're sitting in the hall, what kind of popcorn you're eating, what your mood is at that time. The experience will differ, but there's less singularity in that kind of interaction. So the aura is generated, I would say, in the interaction. It lends a certain kind of unique relationality and conversation between a viewer and a work of art. I think Benjamin's argument could be extended to film as well, as he launches this into a battle between the technology of photography and film. But to return to the copyright law question, let me say that the content of the artwork doesn't matter in this relationship between the viewer and the artwork. It's the co-presence between art and a person and the viewer who's a person. His argument against Benjamin's argument against film is that this recorded series of a number of images moving fast next to each other in a matter of seconds interrupts the power to attend with stillness, which I said earlier, attend with stillness so violently that one can't have a stable relationship with a work of art. And this has not much to do with copyright law in the sense that copyright law protects its uniqueness, but as a matter of property. I don't see aura as relating to a property regime.
Got it. That makes tremendous sense. But I'm going to stick with this point of the interaction between the audience and the work of art for a few more moments. Benjamin talks about, if I may put it loosely, two such forms of interaction. And he points out the distinction between them. He says there is something like immersion, and he gives you this fable of the Chinese painter who gets so absorbed in his own work of art that he's immersed in it completely, and distraction. And he scolds the filmmaker left, right, and center for distracting the audience, and then goes on to say even that it doesn't end there. He says, the distracted mass, and this is on page 33, on the other hand, absorbs the work of art into itself. So I'm not the Chinese painter going into my painting, but the mass is absorbing the work of art into itself. And this, I think, connects to the question we alluded to earlier. Does this then enable the much easier use of mass media as a tool of propaganda?
Right. I was just, as you were speaking, thinking of a breakfast conversation I was having with my mother, where she said, there are all these Bengali soaps that my mother watches. I find them ridiculous, but she often reminds me that if these same stories were told with a Hollywood affect, I would watch them. And so with that censure, I was listening to her speak about a certain character and a girl and a boy who fought and had a massive fight in the soap opera. And then they were found in a mall hanging out together. And the masses, the people who watched that soap went up to them and said, what the hell is going on? How can you guys be friends? You all just fought. It's that kind of distracting.
Can I just add one story here? You know, this reminded me. You know, the old Ramayan serial on television and how much of a cultic value that had.
Of course.
Apparently, the actors who played the deities were on set somewhere else for some other film or show or something of the sort. And after the day's work was done or on some break or something, they were sitting and having a few drinks. And crowds amassed and said, how can you do this?
You're a god.
A god. How can you do this? But I just had to share that one. Go on.
That's exactly it. The distracted mass then absorbs a work of art into reality. And so what Benjamin calls then, we must remember, he's writing at the time of the ascent of the Nazi party, a few years even before the World War II. and propaganda is it has reached the most pernicious form. Benjamin's aesthetic criticism seems to have an element of like these deep fears of what mobs and masses that are blindly led by diktats of powers that be can do, who love and hate without a certain kind of judiciousness. Either they love crazily and without judgment, or they hate without judgment. And he's very aware that this is going on in Germany at that time. And art is an important instrument. Mass art, popular art, is an important instrument that makes this process happen. Mass media is not only an easy tool of political propaganda, but something, in Benjamin's estimation, kind of vulgar. Benjamin is kind of very offended by the vulgarity of it. Something that destroys the delicacy of the human consciousness and cheapens art to reduce it to entertainment. But I will say, though, at the end, where he talks about the aestheticization of political life that you allure to in your question at the very end of the essay, he's saying at the very end, war is beautiful because it ushers in the dreamt of metallization of the human body. War is beautiful because it enriches a meadow in bloom by adding fiery orchids of machine guns. And that those are fantastic and thoroughly scary lines to read, right? And he's basically saying it's technology and modernity's assessment and investment of technology that is fundamentally responsible for this aestheticization project. Modernity has within it the germs of fascism sown. Fascism has not come from without, it has come from within. We have bred it. And this is what Hannah Arendt says, this is what Benjamin says, this is what Adorno has said. So it's very important to remember today, as we face a difficult time in the world and in our country, to remember that there's a certain kind of hotbed, a certain kind of ecosystem that modern high modernity, with its kind of like Uri type modernity, where there's this kind of cool guy who comes and wins the war and who can, or Top Gun Maverick, with Tom Cruise, like fighting these F-16s through a narrow mountain range and things like that. I love the film, but whatever. I don't like Uri though. But these are the cinematic formats into which a certain kind of aestheticization of the technological side of war as aesthetics is fed into our minds, and we are sitting here watching all these beautiful side special effects that Hollywood is producing, knowing that there is a good war and a bad war. Of course, we must be fighting the good war, and we are always on the side of the good war. And when the bad war actually kind of rises up, then we are like, oh my God, there's a bad war out there. But we didn't realize that we were all this while cheering away at war. And that's what Benjamin is, I think, at the end warning us against, us, being progressive readers, New York Times reading, coffee drinking, whatever kind of readers, who are very quick to other fascism as something that's, that's kind of like a zombie form of politics. No, it breeds right here in the ecosystem that we are so much a part of and we participate in very actively.
I would think so. And I think, that's really the sting in the tail of the essay, as it were. I plow through about 37, 38 really dense, difficult pages, and you see afterward and you're like, chalo, okay, all the heavy lifting has been done. And I think we have to read this out. This is right at the end. He says, humanity, which in Homer's day provided a spectacle for the gods of Olympus, has now become one for itself. Its alienation from itself has reached a point where it now allows its own destruction to be savored as an aesthetic pleasure of the first order. Right? He says this, and this follows on from how he talks about how fascism leads logically to an aestheticization of political life and to an aesthetics of war. But then here's the twist once more at the end. The last thing he says before he leaves us is, that is how things are, given the kind of aestheticization of politics that fascism pursues. Communism's reply is to politicize art. And I think really that's sort of the takeaway there. I was going to go on and ask about who I'm sure is your favorite actor, Akshay Kumar, and your favorite director, Vivek Agnihotri, and their films. But I think you have spoken to that already. You've spoken about Uri, etc., all of that. This was fantastic. I can't wait now to decide which book we're going to pick up next. Thank you.
This was great. Thank you. Thank you. This was, we had so much fun.
Thank you very much for tuning in and listening. Stay tuned. Please subscribe. Our podcast is now available wherever you get fine podcasts. Thank you.